Tonight's year being has been sponsored in honor of Amanda by someone who thinks the world of her, and we all appreciate that she sent him out here to join us today. Hashem should bless them both, and the Shekhinah should always be found in their home.
Amen.
We're doing the Ein Yaakov, and we've been learning about the importance of getting in the Musaf prayer on time. And people are late with the Musaf prayer, so the verse says that on the one hand, they can get away with it, they can still say the Musaf prayer, but on the other hand, they're held accountable, and it's those that are late, it's improper. And that's where we left off. And time is something that people have a hard time with, to choose the fun. Being there on time. One of the tips is getting there early. So, I'm saying, I used to have a Seder when I was in Yeshiva. I used to have a Chavrusa before Mincha Friday afternoon. Because I'd always show up late to Mincha Friday afternoons. I said, how do I get to show up on time? I'll show up late to the Chavrusa, not late to Mincha. I set up a Chavrusa before Mincha with the understanding that we could each show up late. Now at least I was on time for Mincha. Hopefully. So we have to figure out tricks how to get there on time. A person is supposed to be there before the time of Tefillah. Ideally, a person is supposed to come to Shul early enough that he could learn a little bit before Tefillah, or he could focus his thoughts. Ideally, a person is supposed to enter Tefillah out of moments where he sat and thought, who's he about to talk to? When we get to the end of Birkot Kriyat Shema, when we're about to stand Shmoneh Esrei, you're supposed to stand up in the position of Shmoneh Esrei when you're a few sentences before Shmoneh Esrei. And then you finish the blessing, Baruch Te Hashem Gal Yisrael. You don't begin Shmoneh Esrei right away, but rather you pause. And you think for a few moments, who am I going to talk to now? A person's supposed to stop and think. And if you apply these halachos realistically in your lives, you'll notice that prayer is something completely different. As Hashem, later tonight in our Binyan Abayit class, we're going to discuss prayer as a tool, as a practical tool for helping one build one's traits. But now we're discussing the importance of being on time. Well, part of being on time is planning ahead and trying to find tricks to get there on time. So, ideally, the Musaf prayer should be prayed, we were taught, within the first 7 hours of the day, and we discussed that hours of the day in their lives were going with sundials, so it's really percentages of the day. Adam Yechesto, right?
Yeah.
Nathaniel Frankenthal.
Okay. Awesome.
No problem.
Is Musaf this set on Saturday?
So Musaf is the added sacrifice, meaning every day has two given sacrifices, the morning and the evening.
Right.
And Musaf is the added sacrifice which was added in honor of Shabbat, in honor of Rosh Chodesh, in honor of Yom Kippur, right, in honor of every holiday. You're right, it's said on Shabbat, so our prayers correspond to those sacrifices. The morning prayer corresponds to the morning sacrifice, afternoon to the afternoon sacrifice, and the evening prayer to the limbs that were left on top of the altar. And the Musaf prayer corresponds to the Musaf sacrifice. Technically, it could be brought all day long. Technically, one could pray all day long. But what's one showing when one delays the prayer so much that he goes beyond 7 hours into the day? 6 hours is midday, is noon, right? 7 hours is the first hour afternoon. So one is supposed to ensure that he gets in the Musaf prayer before then. We left off, the Gemara brought us support from this understanding from Rav Yosef's translation. And Kedemetavim Rav Yosef, we're at the bottom line. Rav Yosef, did we say any stories about Rav Yosef? Do we know who he is? Not yet. Okay, who's Rav Yosef? In the beginning, we'll tell more stories till you guys are frequent, till you're familiar with the Amoraim, the rabbis that we're learning. We'll tell the story a little bit, a story about each one that I know a story. And then this way, it says when you learn the Talmud and the Mishnah, you're supposed to have in mind who's speaking before us. So the first thing we have to know about Rav Yosef was that he was blind. Blind in Gemara terminology, who knows what it's called? Sagi Nahor. What does Sagi mean? Much. Nahor, light. So in Gemara terminology, we don't want to say he's blind, he sees nothing. So we use positive terminology. We say he has much light. Really, he has no light. And being that we use this as the term for a blind man, this became the classical term for any time we reverse what we mean to say. Whenever we use terminology that means the opposite, just because we don't want to say the opposite, so that's called Lashon Sagi Nahor. the terminology of much light, which is just a way of saying that that form of speech where we mean the reverse of what we said. So Rav Yosef was Saginaho. He was blind. He had much light. And Rav Yosef memorized all of the Shas Mishnah and Raisos. He memorized many Tanakh quotes. And when the chief rabbi passed away, so they sent a letter to Israel from Babylon, where Rav Yosef lived, who should be the next chief rabbi? Rabbi Bar Nachmani or Rav Yosef? Did we discuss Rabbi Bar Nachmani? That he adopted the orphan, Nachmani? We didn't discuss him. We'll get them, we'll discuss him. So Rabbi Bar Nachmani was also knew a tremendous amount, but he was very, very sharp. He knew how to figure things out. If you'd give him two quotes with his analytical acumen, he could figure everything out. But he didn't know as many quotes as Rav Yosef. So the academy in Israel sent back word, even though Rabbi Bar Nachmani is sharper, the next Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the academy, should be Rav Yosef. So Rav Yosef, they had a dream and they interpreted that he would die 2 years after he became head of the academy. So he said, no thanks. Let Rabbi be the head of the academy. So Rabbi became head of the academy for 20 some odd years. Did we discuss this last week? We did discuss it last week. That's what I remember. Okay, so let's continue. So Rav Yosef had a tremendous memory, and he was the greatest quoter of the Targum, the translation. When the Torah was given, it was given also with a translation. And that translation elucidates many verses that we wouldn't understand on our own. So Rav Yosef translates this verse in Tzfania, Tavrati asanehom de Beit Israel al dachu zmane moadaya de Yerushalem. Breaking should come upon the enemies of Israel. This is Lashon Saginaho. He doesn't want to say the Jewish people will be broken down. So he says, a breaking will come on the enemies of the Jews. That's not what he means. He means the Jews. But he uses the term Saginaho. He uses it, saying it in an inverse way. Why? Because they delayed the times, the set times that they should have been there in Jerusalem. So a person is supposed to be there on time and bring his sacrifices on time and his prayers on time. Now we're up to the Mishnah on top of Nun Hei. Will come upon the enemies of Israel. That's how he translated the verse. Nugaimi moeda safti. Those who delayed my set times, I've collected. What does it mean, I've collected? Those who've delayed the set times that they should have been there for the holidays at the Temple Mount to bring their sacrifices, I've collected. Collected is like to be collected to the world to come if they're destroyed. For those who delay the set times, the times of the holidays. So this is understood as a reference to the time of prayer, the prayers of the holiday, the prayer of Musaf. Okay, Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana Ayam Mitpalil. The Mishnah tells us a fascinating thing. Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana was one of the Tanaim, one of the rabbis in the time of the Mishnah, and every time he entered the academy, he'd pray the following prayer. Ayam Mitpalil b'chnisator beit ha-midrash u'b'yitziyatot tfilah k'tzara. They'd see him standing at the door, he'd stop, and his lips would start moving, he'd say a prayer, he'd finish his day learning, he'd stop by the door, whisper a prayer and leave. Amhulo, so they said to him, Mama kom litvilazo, what prayer are you praying now? Shachris, Yidavin, Mincha, it's not time yet. What are you praying when you stand by the door every time before you enter, before you leave? Amalahim, so he said to them, Bichmisati, when I enter the academy of the Beis Medrash, I pray, I shouldn't be the cause of error. Maybe I'll say something wrong. I'll cause everyone else to make a mistake. So I pray before I enter, I shouldn't make a mistake and cause others to err. And when I leave the base medrash, when I leave the academy, I give thanks for my portion. I'm a lucky man. I merited to learn in a base medrash. So I give thanks to God that I merited to learn in a base medrash. What do we learn from here? We learn about his modesty. We learn about appreciation. What does this mean to us? Nothing. Rule. If the Talmud tells us that an individual did something, it means he did it and no one else did. You see, a great rabbi does something unusual. What does it mean for you? Nothing. He does it. Doesn't mean I should do it. The Talmud tells us there was a rabbi who said, my father, on a day that he'd eat meat, he wouldn't drink milk all day long, till the next day. And I'm like vinegar that came from wine. I only wait 6 hours between meat and milk. So you ask yourself, if it's such a good thing to wait all day after you've eaten meat, why don't you do like your father? Was he a glutton? He couldn't wait all day till he ate milk? Answer, no. That was his father's level. He wasn't on that level. If he'd be doing it, he'd be a faker. Sometimes there are levels of piety that are fit for a certain person. And if I do them, I'm a faker. There's no point in my doing them. The acts are a part of the general way a person lives. It's not just, I see what the rabbi's doing, I'll emulate him. No. What's fit for him is not fit for me. If the Mishnah, if all we'd have were this Mishnah, what I'm telling you now is the Rambam. Maimonides writes this on this Mishnah. If all we'd have were this Mishnah, then what we'd learn from the Mishnah is that there was once a very pious rabbi who used to pray before he entered the academy and before he left the academy. And what does it mean to us? Nothing. It means we learn about being pious. The Talmud will tell us that it was instituted, and every person before entering the academy and before leaving should say the prayer. And you'll see, they usually have it posted by the Beit Midrash. It's printed in the beginning of the Gemaros. You can find it, and you know, you now know where it is in the Talmud, so you could just say it out of the Gemara. We're about to learn it. And it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch as well. But if all we had were this Mishnah, then we'd know there was an exceptional rabbi who did something. That doesn't mean I should do it. You guys got that? It's a big mistake guys do, especially guys come, they're chozer b'tshuvah, they see someone who says, oh, it's a pious thing to wake up early to daven. So they start waking up at 4 o'clock in the morning. They see someone else who says, yeah, you should be up to midnight to say tikkun chatzos. So they stay up to midnight to say tikkun chatzos. Now they're down to 3 hours of sleep. So they're dozing on the Gemara. And then they hear about a great rabbi who was dozing on the Gemara and he put his feet in buckets of ice water. So they try that. And eventually they go insane and it doesn't work. So you think I'm joking? There are people who went insane, literally, from trying to learn Torah. And it's not only something which we've witnessed, it's something which is quoted in Halacha. The Halacha says it's preferable a person not take a nap during the afternoon. It's preferable that a person sleep at night and be awake and function during the day. But, says the Halacha, what happens if a person sees he needs a nap? For example, he's learning, and if he doesn't take a nap, says in Halacha, he'll go insane from his learning. Sometimes from learning, a person could go insane. A person has to know to take a break. And then, of course, a person should take a nap. And you can't just learn from every story you hear. You'll hear a lot of Hasidic stories. Don't learn from them. And you can't learn from even things that you witness. If this rabbi does this, you don't know what other things he's doing to balance it out. There's a rabbi who answers questions between 1 o'clock in the morning and 3 o'clock in the morning. What you don't know is that he naps between 1 o'clock in the afternoon and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. He makes up that sleep. And you'll see only the tail end of what a person does. You can't learn from that. And even if he doesn't nap, well, maybe that's what fits him. But that's not necessarily what fits you. Every one of us has what fits us. We can't learn from one action. Kevin, I'm with you.
So, I guess what you're saying though with that prayer that he said, that it's now something that we do all day, but that's not because, it's because
later on the rabbis,
and they said, okay, this is right, what we should adopt.
Correct.
Okay, but it wasn't, okay. But if we just read the Talmud or whatever, and we see a story, we don't go out.
Right.
Okay.
And even if you read a story about a Hasidish Rebbe, and even if you hear that there is an opinion that says you should do this, so there's an opinion that says you should do this. People tell me, Rav Kook said you shouldn't shave, so I'm not shaving. Okay, Rav Kook also said that there's a special way you should say the blessing of Purim and Parshas after you ate meat and eggs, and no one does that. So why'd you choose this thing that Rav Kook said and not that thing? Because you didn't know he said the other thing. Right, so just because you know this doesn't mean you should do it. And you should have your rabbi, and your rabbi will help you figure out what you should do. You can't just say, well, I heard someone says it. Well, what? Someone says it. Okay, there is such an opinion. Ask your rabbi whether it's fitting for you. And sometimes we say just because the Talmud says one rabbi did it, it's indicating that that rabbi did it, no one else did it, so we don't have to do it. So here, the Gemara is going to tell us, and now we'll read the first line in the Gemara, Tanu Rabbanan. What does Tanu Rabbanan mean? Rabbis taught, but whenever we have Tanu Rabbanan, it is indicating that this is a braisa. What is braisa? What does bra mean? Bra means external. Braisa is a Tanaic quote that is external to the Mishnah. Braisa Bra means external. Braisa is a Tanai quote that is external to the Mishnah. Now, they had thousands, if not millions, of Tanoic quotes that the Tanaim quoted or alone. And then along came the rabbis and said, we have to distill this, we have to figure out, can't memorize all this, especially now that we're going into exile, and we won't be able to keep up with all this. So the rabbi sat and formulated these, we could verify that they're valid, they have a good source, the students memorized them 100% accurately. The other ones we don't know, so we sometimes quote the other ones. But sometimes the Talmud will say, well, that wasn't even quoted right. That doesn't begin to be right. Sometimes the Talmud will say, Mishabeshtahi, that quote, way off. We're not going with that. When the Gemara begins a Tanoic quote with Tanu Rabbanon, what it means is, this quote that we're quoting, this Braisa, was validated by the Academy of Rav Chiya or Rabbi Oshaya. One of those two academies sat down and validated that this Braisa is a good Braisa. It's a good quote, and then it's going to be much more difficult to argue with that quote. That quote has much more validity. Whenever we have a Braisa versus a Mishnah, well, the Mishnah was given validation by Rebbe and the High Court. The other ones were given by academies. So the Mishnah wins, Mishnah versus Braisa. But if you have a Braisa that begins with Tanu Rabbanan, it means this Braisa has been validated. Yeah? Tanya is a Braisa, not necessarily with Rav Chiya. Correct. Correct. So the Braisa says as following. What's a Braisa? Who remembers? Braisa is any Tanai quote that's external to the Mishnah. What's the root of the word Braisa? Bra. Bra, external. Milagav is internal. Gav is inside. Bra is outside. Tanu Rabbanon. What?
Huh?
No problem.
So can you go over those terms again?
Sure.
A little bit slower.
Bra is external. Braisa is the Tanoic quotes that are external to the Mishnah, which encompasses everything outside of Mishnah. All Tanoic quotes outside of Mishnah are called Braisa. They can be broken down. You have a Tosefta, you have Sifri, Sifra. We'll discuss that at a different date. Right now, we're just getting a coarse view. There's Mishnah and everything outside of Mishnah. Everything outside of Mishnah, all Tanoic quotes outside of Mishnah are called Braisa. Bra means external. Braisa are those Tanoic quotes which are outside of the Mishnah. There were those that were validated by the academies of Rav Chiya and Rav Oshaya, and those are introduced with Tanu Rabbanan. To give Kevin time to write, we'll say a story about Rav Chiya, and then we'll have to call it a day, and we'll pick up over here next week. Who was Rav Chiya? Guys, the stories are important. They'll give you perspective with who these rabbis are. So we know that Rebbe was the prince. We'll begin with Rebbe. We'll never get to Rav Chiya today. We'll have to get to Rav Chiya a different time. Who was Rebbe? Rebbe was Rebbe Yehuda HaNasi. When Rebbe was born, the Romans were ruling over Israel. We're talking about the period after the destruction of the Second Temple. King David's dynasty was almost wiped out. At one point, King David cursed his nephew, Yoav. And then Yoav, when it came time to be executed, said, I'm not moving until you accept the curses back on yourself. And King David accepted the curses. And so his family was almost wiped out. There was only one kid left. And the Davidic dynasty continued from that kid down to Hillel. We've all heard of Hillel. Hillel was the leader of the Jewish people, exceptionally modest, began his life as a pauper, gave away everything just to learn Torah, and eventually became very wealthy, became the prince who led the Jewish people 100 years before the destruction of the temple, a direct descendant from King David. Hillel had a son named Shimon, who had a son named Gamliel, who had a son named Shimon. Hillel, Shimon, Gamliel, Shimon led the Jewish people those four generations, the 100 years prior to the destruction of the temple. Then we continue down a few generations till Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was the leader of the Jewish people who saw that the Jews were being persecuted, chased by the Romans. They're making decrees that the Jews can't learn. Jews are being sent into exile all over, and they could no longer sit together and study the oral law and maintain it the way they should. So he said, even though the Torah tells us the written law must be read from writing, you don't say it by heart. The oral law must be redacted orally, you can't write it down. But Eis Lasos Lashem, the period has come that we have to recognize that if we don't break that one law, all of the Torah will be forgotten. Rebbe convened the courts with him and said, together we must write down at least the headings of the oral law. They sat down and they put together the Mishnah. The first time in world history that one version of the oral law was written and agreed upon, and that people didn't go by the tradition they got from their Rebbe, but rather there was a basis for the oral law in the Mishnah that was accepted by all the rabbis, by the high court of Rebbe. Now, how could Rebbe do this? When Rebbe was born, there was a decree by the Romans that no one could circumcise their children. Rebbe's father was the Nasi, the priest, the prince. And we know that when the Gentiles make a decree that's called Shman, a decree with the sole intent of causing us to go against the Torah, to lose our faith, then we say, even for the smallest decree, we go against it. Then we're brazen. We say, you told us not to wear a talis. We're going to wear a talis. We know ordinarily there are only three mitzvot we should give up our lives rather than transgress. But if their goal is to break our spirit, to break us from keeping the Torah, then we say over the smallest mitzvah, we're going to fight them. Doesn't matter what. They tell us, Jews, you're modest. You commemorate the temple by wearing black shoelaces. No more black shoelaces. Only white shoelaces. All the Jews wear black shoelaces the next day. Even at the threat of being killed. Because we say when they're trying to break our spirit, then we stand up to them on the smallest mitzvah. We can't now, David, sorry. So the Romans had decreed that no circumcisions. Rebbe's father does a circumcision. The Romans send their troops. They take Rebbe's mother. They take the baby. And they're going en route to Rome to judge them for going against the Roman decree. They're en route, and they stop by a Roman inn. The woman at the inn had just given birth to a baby boy. And the woman at the inn tells Rebbe's mother, you know what? Let's switch babies. They'll never know the difference. I didn't circumcise my baby. You take my baby up to Rome. When they take you in front of the judge, pull off the diapers. They'll see he's got a foreskin, never been circumcised. We'll save everyone and everything's fine. They do it. Now, this is a tremendous act of piety. Because she couldn't know what would happen up there at the high courts. But she did it. She switched babies. She took Rebbe Yehuda Anasi, she nursed him, she sent her baby, his name was Antoninus. Rebbe's mother took him up to the high courts, they pulled off the diaper, they saw the kid had a foreskin, they said, we don't know what you want from these people, sent them back home. On the way back home, they switched babies back, and Rebbe grew up to be the great sage of the Jewish people, and Antoninus became the emperor of Rome, this same baby. And Antoninus sent questions to Rebbe, and they formed a friendship. Reb Antoninus would leave his palace with two guards to go learn by Rebbe, and he didn't want word to spread. So when he'd enter Rebbe's home, he'd kill the first guard. And when he'd get back home, he'd kill the second guard. And no one knew that Antoninus was coming to Rebbe to learn Torah, and Antoninus even became Jewish. There are stories about that. You'll hear them at a different time. Right now, we can't go into that. At the end of the day, Antoninus gave Rebbe all the leeway he wanted. Rebbe was exceptionally wealthy. Rebbe and Antoninus were both the wealthiest people in the world at the time. And Rebbe had the friendship with Antoninus. Rebbe recognized the pivotal point in Jewish history that he stood in. Rebbe recognized that this might be the last time the Jews would have it so good. And this takes great wisdom, because most people, when they're making money, they take out a mortgage on more money because they assume tomorrow I'll have this money. Everyone, that's the way everyone works. When things are going good, they assume it's going good forever. When things are going bad, they assume it's going bad forever. That's the way people's minds work, except for great people. That was the greatness of Rebbe. He recognized that this was a golden opportunity in world history. He didn't say, well, things are going good, must be they'll keep going good. He said, no, things are going good, and next generation they might be very bad again. So we're going to convene all the rabbis. Now that we have peace, now that we have the friendship with Antoninus, we're going to take advantage of that, put all the rabbis together, and put together a basis for the oral law, and he put together the Mishnah. And that's the Mishnah that we have here today. Next time, Hashem, we'll continue. Well, we have another 2 minutes. Who was Rebbe Chiya? Rebbe Chiya was Rebbe's disciple, but he was also very, very big. Rebbe Chiya is still the generation of Tanoim. Rebbe had another disciple, actually a disciple of Rebbe Chiya's. His name was Rav. Rav was the first generation of Amoraim, of rabbis of the Talmud. Amoraim comes from the word emor, to say over. The Talmud was always said over by heart. That's the heart of the oral law. That's why they're called Amoraim. And if you listen to Yemenites or Sephardim, they don't call them Amoraim, they call them Emoraim, from the word Emor, to say over. In Hebrew, the Patach, the A, and the Segel, the E, are really very similar meaning. That's why when you read the Rishonim, the earlier commentaries, they refer to them both as a patach. A segol in Rashi sometimes is referred to as a patach. Patach is the A, the flat line. Segol is the three dots, right? Like the three on a cube. The segol is the E, patach is the A, but in Hebrew they have a similar meaning. So Amoram and Emoram is really the same idea. They're the ones who set over the oral law. Rav, who was Rav Chiya's disciple, we said Rav Chiya and Rebbe were together. Rav was the first generation of Amoraim, and he was the borderline generation. He could still argue with rabbis of the Mishnah, even though he was one of the rabbis of the Talmud. And here we do have to pause, so we'll pick up here Bezat Shem next week with our Gemara. So,